Coming up next, Louisiana Eats is in Denver, Colorado for Slow Food Nations. The event celebrates slow and sustainable food systems through summits, workshops, and a street festival.
What is beginning to take shape all over America is this idea of reinventing communities and economies through food. And Denver is this really interesting intersection where innovation is beginning to rediscover tradition.
We speak with Executive Director Richard McCarthy, then Raj Patel joins us to talk about food waste.
You don't fix poverty by giving poor people scraps from the table. In the end, you don't fix hunger with food. Hunger is a chronic condition that means ending poverty.
We're traveling to the Mile High City for Slow Food Nations. That's coming up next. But first, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The late Senator John McCain lies in state at the Capitol Rotunda in Phoenix, Arizona. His family, friends, and political associates gathered for memorial service a short time ago. Eyes were fixed on McCain's flag-draped coffin, and there were tears as speakers remembered McCain as a man of integrity. Reflecting on the life of his political colleague and friend, former Senator John Kyle said McCain had better instincts about how and when to assert American power than any other leader he'd known.
One illustration that we're all familiar with was when others were looking into Vladimir Putin's eyes with an eye of understanding him and reaching accommodation with him. John, of course, said, "I looked into his eyes and I saw KGB.
McCain had harshly criticized President Donald Trump's meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin in Helsinki in recent months. He called it one of the most disgraceful performances by an American president in memory. Several political leaders, including former rivals, have been invited to take part in memorial services for McCain in the coming days. President Trump is not one of them. McCain passed away on Saturday of cancer. He was 81 years old. White House counsel Don McGahn is stepping down this fall. NPR's Scott Horsley reports President Trump announced the lawyer's departure with a tweet this morning.
McGahn had been widely expected to step down after shepherding Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh through the confirmation process. McGahn also served as Trump's campaign lawyer. In his tweet, the president said he truly appreciates McGahn's service. McGahn has been the architect of Trump's effort to fill the federal bench with more conservative judges, a plan that was made possible with the help of Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell. He also suggested during the campaign that Trump publish a list of possible Supreme Court nominees, an idea that contributed to Trump's strong backing among social conservatives. McGahn was in the news recently when it was reported that he spent hours answering questions from investigators working with special counsel Robert Mueller. Scott Horsley, NPR News.
About two dozen guards and inmates in Ohio have been rushed to hospitals, treated for possible drug exposure. Here's Ohio Public Radio's Joe Ingles.
Ohio State Highway Patrol Lieutenant Robert Sellers says a total of 24 people, including guards, nurses, and inmates at the Ross Correctional Institution, have been exposed to some sort of substance. They've been taken to the local hospital for treatment. Sellers says several doses of Narcan were administered at the scene and an additional 300 doses are available. He says all people who were in the contaminated area have been temporarily relocated within the facility. A hazardous contamination team is on its way to deal with the cleanup. The exposure happened shortly after 9 a.m. State and local authorities are continuing to investigate the situation.
This is NPR News. An Israeli court has ruled that a group of Israeli settlers who built homes on privately owned Palestinian land has rights to the land. Israeli nationalists say the ruling sets a precedent for settlements in the Israeli-occupied West Bank. And NPR's Daniel Estrin has more from Jerusalem.
In the past, Israel's Supreme Court has ordered Israeli settlers to evacuate lands in the West Bank belonging to private Palestinian landowners. But now a lower court says one small settlement on private land may stay. The court ruled that the settlers acted in, quote, good faith because they did not know the land was owned privately and because they'd received government backing in the process. Instead of demanding the settlers evacuate the land, the court ruled the Palestinian landowners are entitled to compensation. Israel's justice minister from a pro-settler party said it was an important achievement for the Israeli settler movement. Israel captured the West Bank 51 years ago. Most countries reject Israeli settlements there. Palestinians want the land for an independent state. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Jerusalem.
Cleveland Browns linebacker Michael Kendricks is charged with financially benefiting from insider trading. Today he apologized for his actions, saying he put his faith in a former friend he thought he could trust. In Philadelphia, U.S. Attorney William McSwain said Kendricks' associate, ex-investment banker Demilary Sinoiki, received cash and other kickbacks in exchange for passing on insider trading tips. For his part, Kendricks has pledged to pay back more than $1 million that he made off the scheme. The Dow is up 58 points. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include LogMeIn, makers of GoToMeeting, a collaborative meeting platform with over 18 million monthly users, designed to connect people from anywhere in the world on any device. Learn more at GoToMeeting.com.
For a delightful listening experience on Friday afternoons, why not tune in to Freetown Radio at 3? It'll cure what ails you, and it's only on KRVS 88.7 FM and KRVS.org on the web. Turn your radio on.
Turn your radio on. Turn your radio on and listen to the music in the air.
Louisiana Eats is brought to you with support from Zatarain's, maker of New Orleans pantry staples like Creole mustard, fish fry, and jambalaya mix since 1889. Recipes and more at Zatarain's.com. From our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum in New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. Recently, the Louisiana Eats team traveled to Denver, Colorado for Slow Food Nations. There, we joined food leaders from across the world for an amazing 3 days of riveting conversation and extraordinary eating. We begin with New Orleans' own Richard McCarthy, founder of the Crescent City Farmers Market, who today heads up Slow Food USA. Then we'll get a global view of the movement from Slow Food International's General Secretary, Paolo Di Croce. And we sit down with the rock star of today's social justice writing, Raj Patel, who takes us on an exploration of fairness and equity in food, a topic Chef Massimo Baturo cares about passionately. Massimo journeyed from his 3 Michelin star restaurant in Milan to be there. There's lots of heady food for thought mixed in with some down-home anarchy on this week's Louisiana Eats.
I'm Richard McCarthy, Executive Director for Slow Food USA.
At Slow Food Nations, there's really no such thing as small talk. Each conversation seems to spark a revelation about how food can transform society. That was certainly the case when we ran into Richard McCarthy. The festival's theme this year was Food for Change, and Richard was more than ready to share his thoughts with us, particularly about food's potential to be an antidote to our society's polarizations. To begin, I asked Richard to illuminate the concept behind Slow Food Nations.
Well, our idea is to bring to the middle of the country the ideas that have permeated on the coasts, especially in the particularly humid coasts, a desire to bring what is beginning to take shape all over America is this idea of reinventing communities and economies and places through food. And Denver is this really interesting intersection where the mountains collide with the plains and where innovation is beginning to rediscover tradition, especially when you think of Colorado and the First Nations foods that in this day and age of dramatic climate change, we need to begin to rediscover the biodiversity of foods that are grown in a region because they want to be grown in a region. And, you know, for those of us in Louisiana, the idea of the taste of place, of course, is so automatic and natural and innate. But this idea is beginning to take shape. When I travel all over the United States, I see communities that are becoming alive because in the town square, there's an independent brewer, a distiller, a restaurant that's connected to farmers. Places are beginning to reinvent themselves through food. We're beginning to build bridges between urban and rural through food. And we felt that it was time to take these precious, but they shouldn't be precious, but precious ideas about traditional foods and increasingly youthful innovation around food as being a tool, a stepping stone to build community and bring people together. But not to do it in a conference, not to do it just in restaurants and white tablecloths, but to bring it into the street. So what we're staging in Denver, in downtown Denver, is a street festival. And we are encountering people who had no idea who Slow Food was, and they're looking for navigation. They're trying to figure out, how do I navigate these difficult food choices for my family? And we don't do that through serious lectures, though we have some serious lectures. We do it through taste and enjoyment and pleasure. And that is how we build community. So that is the idea of taking these ideas into the middle of America and bridging relationships that have not yet been formed until people join us at the table.
How hard was it to persuade all of these superstars to come be here with you in Denver?
I think it's been one of the more humbling elements is we've been able to ask, I mean, people I idolize, people who I think are real leaders and risk takers and visionaries, and we've asked them not to attend a conference, but to meet America. And whether they're from the U.S. or from the various nations who are descending here, there's a real excitement to be able to discuss these very provocative, controversial ideas with the general public, not just with food movement insiders. And either we're going to have the semblance of a social contract that we care for each other, that we eat with each other, or we don't. And I think people recognize the importance of taking these revolutionary ideas at a time that needs to build a, you know, this strange food politics of intimacy where we are involved in each other's lives. I mean, that's what drove me when I think years back, 20 years ago, farmers markets were exciting to me because we could bring urban with rural, black with white, young with old, indigenous with immigrant. That is the power of food. And while in New Orleans, we have a very clear narrative that we love and desire to integrate. In the rest of the country, urban runs away from rural, old runs away from young, and I think that is an idea that Slow Food brings, not again through lecturing, but through joy and pleasure. And my God, we need pleasure right now.
I'd like you to expound a little bit more on the, what was that phrase you used?
The politics of intimacy, that we can only truly change our communities, our relationships, if we have relationships with each other. If we're not just reading about how do we take care of the other, how do we attend to the other, if we do not have intimate relationships, involved intimately in each other's lives, there's no way we can build solidarity, no way we can legislate for rural communities if we don't know people who live in rural communities, or vice versa. We so quickly isolate and demonize the other. And there is another way. And the other way is to be intimately involved in each other's lives, living near people, fishing with other people. I mean, food is particularly provocative in this space. Because in a way, we don't have to know or like the other people. We just like what they grow or what they harvest or what they raise. But as we begin to eat their food, as we begin to purchase from them, we begin to have relationships on each other. We begin with each other. We begin to rely on each other. And I think through interventions like street festivals, like farmers markets, like community kitchens, like school gardens, we begin to be involved in each other's lives. And that's when we begin to care about each other.
What is it that everyone who's listening to us can do to begin to affect these changes themselves?
I would say that there is no clear line of you can do this and you shouldn't do that. Probably the single most important thing you can do is cook a meal together with people you love at least once a week and sit down around the table and talk. And you don't even have to talk about food, but put away the phones, slow down, and enjoy each other through food. That's why it's there.
Thank you so much for taking this time to talk with us on Louisiana Eats. And I hope it's not too long before we get to do it again.
Oh, I hope so too, Poppy. This is the highlight of my weekend.
Richard McCarthy, Executive Director for Slow Food USA. When we come back from a short break, we meet more national and international food leaders at Slow Food Nations in Denver. Louisiana Eats returns in a moment.
Let us help you make sense of the enormous volume of new music now available as we continue our review of some of the best new sounds from rising names and favourite artists on the Thistle and Shamrock this week.
Coming up Sunday at 6 p.m. on KRVS.
You know that little sticker on fruit, how when you pick it off, it, like, damages the fruit?
And then trying to flick it off your fingers, right? And you're like, why does it have to be so hard?
That is design. And design affects everything around us.
And if done right, everything around us could be transformed to bring a better experience.
Ideas about the power of design, that's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
8 o'clock tonight on KRVS.
From the University of Louisiana at Lafayette, this is KRVS 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles.
I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Rouse's Markets, from Camellia Brand, Beans Done Right, a New Orleans tradition since 1923, and from Ralph Brennan's Redfish Grill. From dock to pot, offering 9 varieties of fresh Gulf fish daily. Lunch, dinner, and private events at 115 Bourbon Street in the French Quarter.
My name is Paolo Di Croce. I'm the General Secretary of Slow Food International.
For a worldwide perspective, we now turn to Paolo Di Croce. Paolo's been involved with Slow Food since the late 1990s, coordinating projects like the Arc of Taste. Since 2005, Paolo has been serving as Secretary of Slow Food International's Board of Directors, the highest governing body of Slow Food. When I spoke to Paolo, I asked him to share the global view of what's happening with slow food in the world today.
I think that I can say that starting that we are quite happy because our movement is growing. We are in 150 countries. We reach regularly more than 1 million people, activists, individuals who are part of our network. And we really work to try to have a much bigger impact in trying to change the food system and to create a planet where, as we say, every single person should have the right to access to good, clean and fair food. So food that is healthy and tasty, food that is environmentally friendly and food that respects the role of farmers that too often they do not earn enough money for the job that they do. We have to give more value to the food. We live in a world where we spend more money on smartphones and on cars than on food. It's something, from our perspective, wrong. I think that the day that we will give more value to food, the day that we will give more value to food producers, we will be more happy and we will help to create a sustainable planet for the future generations.
Is there anything that you could suggest people do, a simple anything in their lives that could make a difference in the overall picture?
If we are lucky, we eat at least twice a day. And I say if we are lucky because we are never to forget that today on this planet there are still more than 800 million people starving. But apart from that, when you eat, you can make very simple daily choices. Eat local, eat less, waste less. In the States, is a country like Europe where we waste 40% of the food that we buy. It's money, it's something against the environment, it's something against nature. It's seasonal. Cook sometimes. We live in a planet where we have stopped to cook and to share some food with friends and families. It's one of the nicest things that we can do. We are not obliged to eat alone in a big plate, a gigantic steak. Life is much better than this. And I really think that it's a cultural element. It's not money. It's not a matter of money. It's a matter of culture, it's a matter of interest, and it's a matter of priority. We have the same problems everywhere. The problems you are facing here are the same that we are facing in Europe, and they are facing in Japan, and they are facing other places. So I think that if we are curious about what we eat, and if we are curious about diversity also of people and connection, it's nice to meet people. It's nice to meet diversity, and especially in this period of a political situation that it's, you know, here in Europe, in other places, is not too open. We are working to build walls. I think that we have to have relationships with any kind of different cultures, to share ideas, to share food. And sharing food, I think, is one of the best way to get to know diversity and get to understand that the diversity is something nice and not something dangerous.
Give me your view on how we're doing here as Americans and what Slow Food International's hopes are for us.
You know, the U.S., this country is the country that in the global image is the country who invented fast food, is the opposite of what we are trying to promote. But on the other hand, I strongly believe that is the country that can have one of the maybe the biggest impact also on the rest of the world, not only here. And compared to when we started now many, many years ago, I think that there is a good trend. I think that a number of people in this country interested in organic, interested in healthy food, interested also in slow food is growing. So my hope for the future is that Slow Food USA can become stronger. It's not like we are in Italy, it's not yet like we are in Germany, it's not yet like we are in other countries, but it's increasing. I also hope that being this event in Denver can help in raising our image, in having new people who maybe do not know now what we are, and they can understand what we do, and maybe one day they will join us and help us in our fight.
Slow Food International General Secretary, Paolo Di Croce.
My name's Raj Patel, and I'm a research professor at the Lyndon Baines Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Austin at Texas.
Raj Patel came to Slow Food Nations as an observer. But by the end of the festival, his observations had given life to some pretty compelling ideas. As public affairs professor, Raj spends a lot of time thinking about the notions of fairness and equity, two values that can definitely be applied to food. He has a way of taking highly empathetic concepts and turning them into concrete solutions. I asked Raj where he finds his unending motivation.
When I was five, my parents took me to India, the land of our ancestors, and I remember being stopped in the middle of a monsoon at a traffic light, and there was a girl wailing outside the window, and in her arms was a howling baby. And the girl can't have been more than 12 years old, and she was asking for money, and I was looking up at her, and I just didn't understand why she was hungry, and it didn't make sense to me that we on the inside of the car were dry and she was wet, that we had money and that she didn't. We had food and she was hungry. And, I mean, every five-year-old experiences that moment of, that's not fair. I mean, you go to any playground, you will hear, that's not fair. And most adults also have a rich sense of, that's not fair. And for me, that's not fair moment came when I was 5 years old and it was around food.
Talk to us about your thoughts on eating local versus global and the possibility that maybe global isn't that bad.
I love the idea of people being able to eat well and that everyone who is involved in food production gets paid well. One way that's been presented as a way of doing that is by eating local. And I want that to be true. Sometimes it's true that actually when you're eating locally at a restaurant, for example, that everyone in that kitchen is being paid well. It's not just about the local produce being grown in the fields and the farmer being paid well, but also I want the farmhands to be paid well. I want the land to have been got legitimately rather than through colonialism. I want the chain that brings the food to the table to involve not just locality but dignity. And that's much harder to shop for and much harder to demand because you don't see it on the label. You have to talk to people. And sometimes those are uncomfortable conversations. I've eaten in restaurants recently where I've said, well, you advertise that this is local and seasonal. Are people being paid fairly? And they say, well, no, we're struggling. We're still at $2.13 an hour for tipped staff. And that's local too. Poverty is local and exploitation is local. And I think it's important for us to remember that there's nothing about local that automatically confers virtue, but we can fight for that and we can demand it. But it's going to involve us thinking much more expansively and in that way much more globally about how it is that our actions have affected other people, rather than just saying, well, all right, it was grown around the corner, everything's automatically okay with it.
If you could implore all of my listeners to make a change in their life, to do one single thing that might begin to be the difference that you want to see in the world, what would you implore people to do?
I often get asked, I'm just one person, what can I do? And sure, I buy fair trade, shade-grown, organic coffee, for example, because what's the opposite of what are you going to do? Have bastard coffee? No, you don't want children exploited in the manufacture of your coffee. But one of the most important things to realize if we're going to make big systemic change is that you're not just one person. All our food comes to us through rich webs of many hands touching that food. And although it feels like we're just alone, single consumers, in fact, every change that has mattered in the history of humans has been achieved collectively and socially. And so the one thing that I would implore your listeners to do is to reach out and organize, because we're never going to change the world simply by shopping differently. Nothing has ever been achieved that way. If we're interested in justice, if we're interested in tackling climate change, if we're interested in making sure that we have robust and vibrant local economies, if we're interested in eating very well indeed, we should do it together. And so organizing, whether it's through Slow Food or through your union or your church or your cooperative, people are involved in so many networks. Bringing food and hunger issues into those networks and organizing to end hunger, that's the best thing that you can do. And it also makes you feel far more powerful than shopping for the right thing.
Raj, there are many, many organizations that I know tap on you for your time. Why do you choose to work with slow food?
I'm here as an observer. I love the original idea behind slow food, which was about making sure that everyone has pleasure. Not just the rich, but everyone. And Carlo Petrini, one of the motivating forces behind this organization, started in Italy. And what he used to do was him and his buddies would organize and unionize the worst paid people in Italian food. And that was plantation workers or farm workers. And those farm workers got higher wages, and they also got 2 hours for lunch break so that you could not only enjoy the food and you could afford the food, but you could also do all the other things that you need to do during lunch. And I love that idea of democratizing pleasure. Slow food internationally has had something of a reputation as a sort of middle-class supper club, but in its DNA is a much more radical, much more democratic, and much more sort of respectful of the working class vision of how food should be. And I'm here to make sure to see where that is in this organization's future. And what I'm seeing so far makes me very enthusiastic about the possibilities of this organization partnering with working people across America and across the world to make sure that everyone gets to eat delicious food.
One of the things I know that you are addressing while you're here is food waste. Would you give us a little synopsis of what you're presenting about the waste we see in food and what's happening with that?
I'm here rather as a fly in the ointment, I'm afraid. There's a lot of writing about how we shouldn't be wasting food, and you're not going to hear me saying, yes, let's waste food. We shouldn't. 40% of food is wasted globally. In the global south, in poorer countries, it happens in the fields where insects will eat the harvest. In the U.S. and in Europe, it's because we buy food and throw it away. And you're not going to hear me say, well, we should probably carry on doing that. Of course, we should stop doing that. My worry, though, with food waste is that somehow those sort of childhood interactions we have around food waste have come back as policy and as bad policy. You know, like, eat up, there are children starving in Africa. Like, there's a connection between you feeding, finishing your plate and anyone in Africa getting fed. Right now, there are a lot of initiatives that want to say, hey, why don't we take this food waste and give it to poor people? That'll solve hunger. The trouble is, hunger is a chronic condition to do with poverty. You don't fix poverty by giving poor people scraps from the table. In the end, you don't fix hunger with food. And I think that's one of the hard parts for people to understand, particularly in the food waste debate, is that, we see all this food being wasted. Surely, if we just give it to the poor, we solve two problems. No. Poverty is far more complicated than can be solved with scraps from the table. And I think part of what it is that I'm keen to get into a discussion about is how it is that we both recognize that we need to address food waste by changing how it is that everyone eats, but also address poverty in ways that are far deeper than just making sure that we don't buy more than we need.
So you have had this bird's eye view on the food system in a very unique way. What gives you hope, and what are you hoping for?
I like it that more and more people are part of the good food movement. I like it that there are now 200 million farmers, farm workers, landless peasants in a group called La Via Campesina, the international peasant movement that translated means the peasant way. I love it that 20 years ago, many of those small farmers really didn't care about climate change and agroecology and farming in a way that didn't use industrial chemistry, and now pretty much all of them do. I see these changes being led by movements of poor people, whether they're working people in America fighting against exploitation in the meat industry, or movements around tomato pickers in southern Florida. The Coalition of Immokalee Workers has come up with a whole new way of thinking about how to regulate and manage fair trade in food domestically. And movements like La Via Campesina are transforming how it is that we think about globalization and what good can come from globalization, as well as how to fight the bad stuff. That stuff has been fought for much longer than 20 years, but it's lovely to see it blossoming right now, even as the ills that we fight against are also multiplying, whether that's climate change or a new rise of nationalism and xenophobia. So luckily, I think, we never have moments of progress without backlash. That's the way that dialectic, history works. But I'm hopeful for the future based on these, the millions of people who are doing the right thing and fighting the right fight.
That was Raj Patel, Research Professor of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. What is slow food? And just how many nations are involved today? Stay tuned, and we'll answer that question when we come right back.
Get yourself a Tita'sta Cafe and drop a quarter into La Lu Jukebox with me, your host, Blake Miller. This jukebox plays all the good stuff. Cajun, country, small pop, Cajun music that sounds like small pop that sounds like country, country that sounds like Cajun, Cajun that sounds...
That's La Lu Jukebox with Blake Miller, Saturday night at 6 and Sunday morning at 7, right here on KRVS.
This Week in This American Life. I don't know, it's like being bored with fireworks, or it's a metaphor in and of itself. An astronaut goes to the moon, and you know what he's not into? Space.
Was it cool to float around weightless?
No.
Journeys into the not-so-great unknown this week.
Coming up tonight at 7 on KRVS.
Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. Are you podcasting Louisiana Eats yet? If not, it's time to subscribe. Our latest podcast explores the tempestuous depths of global water issues with Elliot Sherman, water scientist at the EPA. Just go to poppytooker.com and click on Quick Bites. Now, back to Louisiana Eats. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. What is slow food, and just how many nations are involved today? Slow food began back in 1986 when the first McDonald's was about to open at the foot of the Spanish Steps in Rome. Founder Carlo Petrini was so horrified by this fast food invasion, he began the slow food movement to combat the effects of fast food in our lives today. He and his cohorts didn't protest with signs, but instead by handing out bowls of penne pasta, a clear illustration of just what they believed was threatened. That was some good pasta. 3 years after the first protest, 15 countries came together to sign a manifesto, which stated, "Our defense should begin at the table. Let us rediscover the flavors and savors of regional cooking and banish the degrading effects of fast food." Today, the movement has spread to over 160 countries, with 150 U.S. chapters boasting over 6,000 members. To learn more about the good works of Slow Food, visit their website, slowfoodusa.org. I'm Poppy Tooker, and slow food always makes for some good Louisiana eats.
Slow down, you move too fast. You got to make the morning last. Just kicking down the cobblestones, looking for fun and feeling groovy. La-da-da-da-da-da, feeling groovy.
My name is Alfonso Rocha, and I'm the director of Slow Food Mexico.
Alfonso Roca founded the Slow Food Mexico chapter in the city of Puebla in February 2012. In October that same year, he was named International Counselor for Mexico and Central America. We met Alfonso at Slow Food Nations, where he shared his passion for protecting traditional Mexican food and the people who bring it to the table. Alfonso, tell us about your work with Slow Food in Mexico. What is Slow Food in Mexico like?
Well, in Mexico, there's a big network of more than 40 local conviviums or chapters in the whole country. We are connected with more than 200 farmers. We have different types of products. We have contact with indigenous communities or with local chefs in the cities. So the network is growing, and many people love the philosophy because in Mexico, fortunately, we still have a lot of the traditional food in the local markets. Slow Food in Mexico began in early 2000 when Carlo Petrini visited the country, and he connected with local chefs in Mexico City. But after several years, when I joined in 2012, during the International Congress, I was named a International Counselor for Slow Food Mexico and Central America. And we decided to make a strategic shift. Instead of being only in restaurants, because Slow Food during 10 years in Mexico, the beginning, it was mostly in restaurants. So we decided to go to the community. So we started opening up new conviviums, local groups in the indigenous community, with women, with young people. So right now, after 18 years of having a presence of Slow Food in Mexico, we have a big community that's not only chefs.
What are some of your projects in Mexico? I know, for instance, you have a Presidia project, correct?
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, we got some grant from different foundations to develop new Presidia. It was a Chile Serrano, a community of indigenous women produce a variety of red Chile Serrano, because you usually see it green, but this is red. And we're developing the pulque, the maguey system, the agave plant that produces tequila, but the maguey is the big plant that produces pulque, which is a millenary fermented drink that was drank in Mexico. So we're developing new procedures to help up new producers to have access to the market, so that they can develop products, packaging, and so we can help curb poverty and migration through the selling or distribution of their traditional foods.
I heard you talking about the outside shell of the cacao, a project you have working with that.
Yeah, the Cacao Presidia, which was founded in 2007 after the International Congress of Slow Food in Mexico. The producer in this Presidia have more than 80 different products. They have chocolates, different types of chocolate delicacies, so to say. So one of these products, the special product that I call it, is the cacao tisane. It's basically the outer shell of the cacao bean that they toast, and you can infuse it with hot water, and you can make a hot chocolate tea, so to say. So instead of giving the animals the shell or using it for compost, you can make a really good drink or even use it for different pastry.
Is it available in the United States yet?
I think you can buy different cacao tisanes from different countries, but this one is not here yet, so that's why we're here at Slow Food Nations, to connect with different businesses to see how we can ship it.
How has Slow Food changed the life of people in Mexico?
Well, first of all, thanks to Slow Food and thanks to the inviting us to different events nationally and internationally, I've seen how farmers, they feel more dignified, they feel more happy with what they're doing. Because unfortunately in Mexico, sometimes farmers are looked down on. It's like a job that's not dignified. So they're honored to know the traditional knowledge that they were passed on. And they're honored and happy to go to another country like the U.S. or to Italy, where Slow Food has an event, and have people from other countries tell them how important their job and their product is. I think that's something that they will pass down to their children. And instead of having people migrate to the city or look for another job, Slow Food is helping that maintain this tradition and farmers to feel happy of what they're doing. I think it's important for people here in the U.S. to also start connecting with people from outside of their comfort zone, so to say. I mean, yes, we want to curb migration. We want to help people that are in a poor situation in another country. But if you go here to any restaurant, you have Mexicans or Latinos cooking there for you. So if you reach out to those communities, and if you can develop maybe a project where you can help their home family develop something like this, a product, maybe those people that are cooking for you would go back, and they maybe would live a dignified life by selling their traditional products back home. But that starts from the people that they connect with here in the U.S. So I would comment that it's important to reach out to other communities that are in your area.
That was Alfonso Roca, International Slow Food Counselor for Mexico and Central America. Among the events that took place at Slow Food Nations was a late-night summit, which brought together two passionate, talented chefs who take sustainability seriously. One was Rick Bayless, chef and owner of Chicago's Frontera Restaurants. The other was Italian chef Massimo Baturo, whose 3 Michelin-starred restaurant in Milan, Osteria Francescana, was recently named number 1 on the world's 50 best list. In the past several years, Baturo has been concentrating on the issue of food waste and now heads Food for Soul, a nonprofit organization creating community kitchens across the globe, promoting social awareness about food waste and hunger. Here are some highlights of their inspiring conversation. Mitchell Davis, Executive Vice President of the James Beard Foundation, moderated the discussion.
So I'm going to start with you, Rick, if I may. And I wanted to be a chef when I was little. It didn't really work out that way, although I'm fortunate to now count many chefs as friends. But I never in a million years thought that would be a political role. And I would like to just ask you, and then I'll ask Massimo, why be political? What has chefs got to do with politics?
You know, I never consider myself political. I just want to create the world that I think should exist. And so I will do whatever I need to do to make that happen. And it's that old thing of live the change that you want to see happen in the world. And I know that that's become a cliche, and I'm almost embarrassed to say it out loud, but it actually is kind of true. If you want to make the world a certain way, then you have to start creating that. So I'm always working on small things because I always feel like I can plant seeds places and then that can grow up and I can turn my attention to something else. So for me, it's all about community development and creating a world that I want to see exist.
Thank you. Massimo, for you, why are you doing this?
I don't know. It's like it's something that came out naturally, you know, when we had to confront the universal exposition in which the theme was Feed the Planet. I just thought, if we stay all together, and we did, you know, we can really make the difference and show the world what a chef can do in 2015, and to show that a chef is much more than the sum of his recipes. Because I grew up like that, you know, in a world in which everybody now are like building walls and keep everyone out. We want to break walls and we want to create hospitality. We want to welcome people as we do in the restaurant every day. You know, it's what we do. It's like restaurant and restore. It comes from the word refeature, to restore, to welcome, to, you know, open the door. Welcome people, sit them, and feed them, you know? For us, it was just a normal situation in which we would stop talking and we start acting, you know. We were like tired of all this Congress and, you know, all over the world. And he said, like, come on, let's do something real. And, you know, confronting the numbers at that moment, you know, we produce food for 12 billion people. We are 7 on the planet, and 860 million people, they don't have anything to eat. And we waste food for 1.3 billion tons, and it's 33% of the production. So this is insane. And I think we have to fight this battle. Mm-hmm. But as Paolo said, you know, we can change the world. I said, if we can change our small neighborhood, will be a great change. And if we all work on change our neighborhood, thousands of neighborhoods will change. And one step at a time, we can make the difference in the world.
These days, both of you, however small the things that you do, have major impacts, obviously. And one of the things, since this is a room full of chefs, I want to talk about is how can they engage in some of these, whether they're your projects, but certainly their own projects, to help make that difference? Because the reality of restaurants is dinner's tonight, people are coming, the stove hood doesn't work, the whatever, all the sort of things that happen in restaurants. And yet, there's something beyond that food, that service that can change the world. So what's some advice?
For me, it's like, you know, I have a small restaurant in Modena in which there are 60 people working there, and we serve 30 guests every lunch and every dinner. And to be as sustainable as we can, you know, we have to practice very hard every day and to feed each one of us, you know. And you know how we are with the palate, so we pretend good food, you know. Lunch and dinner. And so what we do, we use all these different scraps that we have from the preparation, you know, and we teach all the stagiaire, the people that are coming to stage to learn what to do with that kind of food, as my grandmother was teaching me when I was a kid. So these people, they're going to become the new ambassador for this kind of cuisine that put attic close to the aesthetic part. We are like, we became in our small restaurant the ambassador for our farmers, fishermen, cheesemakers, for the artisan. They're giving us the real heroes, you know. They're giving us amazing product and that we use to transfer emotion through our food.
Well, I have a lot of chef friends who get super involved in either the political side or the community development side, and they somehow forget that the food on the plate in the restaurant is the key to everything. And the truth of the matter is, you can only start the conversation if the food on the plate is really good. Mm-hmm. So we all have to be really good cooks. Number one, we have to bring our A game every day to the food on the plate. And we always say our motto in our restaurant is seduce them with flavor. So once they're seduced with the flavor, you can talk to them about anything. Okay? They are putty in your hands. If they're not having a really good time, if they don't like the food, if it's sloppy, if it's not seasoned appropriately, whatever it is, you can't have the conversation because you have not fulfilled your part of the bargain even more so than what they ever anticipated it happening like that.
Massimo, as a chef with a restaurant known, you know, at the highest levels of gastronomy, I'm just wondering if you ever imagined that you were taking a risk by taking a position or by feeding poor people using scraps of waste or something.
Yeah, Lara thought that, you know, she was very scary worried when I decided to feed the planet our own way, you know. And I think it's our job, you know. In cooking, I always write cooking is an act of love, and you can do that for your family, you can do that in your restaurant, and you can do that, you know, for migrants, refugees, homeless. It's the same thing. If you love to cook, you love to cook. and you don't care about anything else, you know? You put the same passion if you have an amazing, beautiful tomato from Vesuvio or some overripe tomato. You just have to ask the right question to the ingredients. And what you can do for me, beautiful tomato? And, you know, it's going to answer. They're going to answer. That's the point, you know? If you have a beautiful piece of bread just baked, it's ready for the table. But if you have one day old, you know, you can slice and make some bruschetta. If it's 3 days old, you can make breadcrumbs and mix with some parmigiano, some eggs, and make a breadcrumbs noodle. That are my son Charlie's favorite meal. So that's the point, you know. It's like, and we have to show this to the world. We have to make visible the invisible, you know, through use our knowledge, our creativity, our things, and, you know, our time dedicate to others, you know. And we did it, and we didn't know, we jumped, we didn't know what to expect. And it was such a big impact that, you know, if you don't jump, if you don't take risk, you're never going to achieve anything, you know. You just have to believe in yourself.
Massimo Baturo and Rick Bayless, speaking at the Late Night Chef Summit at Slow Food Nations in Denver. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Special thanks to our friends and sponsors at Camellia Brand, whose abiding interest in food and culture made our trip to Slow Food Nations possible. To see video excerpts of our time together there, visit Camellia's Facebook page, where you'll find the best forum on bean cookery anywhere. Have you missed an episode of Louisiana Eats? Hear today's show or catch up on previous editions anytime at itsneworleans.com. If you're not podcasting yet, it's time to subscribe. We've launched an exclusive podcast series, Louisiana Eats Quick Bites, made up of sneak previews of material that hasn't hit the airwaves yet and full-length interviews never heard on the show before. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Zatarain's, and Rouse's Markets. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by the Shreveport-Bossier Convention and Tourist Bureau and from Dickie Brennan Steakhouse, a local New Orleans steakhouse serving prime beef and Louisiana Wagyu in New Orleans French Quarter. Original theme music composed by David Pomerleau and performed by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to producers Joe Schreiner, Sarah Holtz, and Reggie Morris. And to our business manager and social media maven, Maddie Mulladew. Come visit us anytime in our Louisiana Eats studios at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. Don't forget to find our recipes and see what we're up to at poppytooker.com. You can check us out on Instagram and Facebook, too. Louisiana Eats is a production of Poppy Tooker Broadcasting.
For Labor Day, we celebrate the blues live at the 2018 Baton Rouge Blues Festival with venerable sounds of Lazy Lester and Duck Holmes. Also, the electrifying next generation, Chris Thomas King, Troy Turner, and Samantha Fish. That plus Cajun R&B from Cowboy Stew. It's blues live for the workers on American Route.